into order and welcome the Department of Environmental Quality. Good to have you aboard. I'm going to ask you to both come up, and Stephanie Hellick, our director, and Valerie Onan, the governmental relations chief. Happy. And we do welcome you. We're interested very much to hear how we've been doing throughout the interim and maybe some of your goals and ideas. So turn it over to you and just let us know who you are.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Stephanie Hellick, and I'm the director of the Department of Environmental Quality. I have been the director for a little over 4 years, but I have been with the department for about 16 and a half years. And some of you I know fairly well, and others not as well, and I look forward to getting to know you this session. Lori Onan is with me today. She is our legislative liaison, and you'll probably see a lot of both of us in the Capitol.
Hope so. Yes.
If I may, just for a moment, I had the opportunity and pleasure last year as chair of Environment and Land Use to work with Stephanie and her staff on numerous issues. First of all, welcome back. And I just wanted to say, Mr. Chair, of all the departments I worked with, this was the most pleasurable and the most accommodating and the one who worked the hardest for me. So,
thank you.
Thank you, Representative Garner.
I guess I probably ought to jump in and say we talked this morning and I really appreciated the willingness of the director and Fazanin to come to Grants Pass to talk to us on some of the problems we were talking down there. So it sure seems to be a very compliant department that really does want to reach out and talk to the people of Oregon. Appreciate that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I will touch on why we like to do business that way as I get into my testimony. What I do want to talk about, and I will try and be brief because I would much prefer to have a dialogue, and I welcome questions at any time because this can be pretty dry, as fascinating as the subject matter may be to all of us. So it would be probably better for everyone if we could engage in a bit of a dialogue. So I welcome that. I do want to give you an overview of how we're structured and how we do our work. My vision for the agency, a brief overview of our programs and of our funding. After I'm done, Lori will talk a bit about our legislative concepts. Those are found in tabs 8 through 11 of the packet that I've given you, and I will refer to the other things in the tab at the appropriate time in my presentation. I'm sure most of you know that Oregon is considered nationally and to a certain extent internationally as a leader on environmental issues. We basically started out dealing with the environmental issues around the Willamette River in the early 1900s when the river was extraordinarily polluted from industry and municipalities. There was a citizens' initiative in the 30s that demanded cleanup of the river and actually formed the State Sanitary Authority, which was the initial foundation for DEQ. DEQ was founded in 1969, and I'm sure many of you know the legacy of former Governor Tom McCall, and our agency was formed when he was in office. In 1972, there was a story in the National Geographic that reported that the Willamette River cleanup had been a success, and that the river at that time was 90% free of the industrial waste and sewage that had polluted it before, which may cause you to wonder why we continue to talk about the pollution of the Willamette River and cleanup of the Willamette River. I will get into more detail about that in a few minutes, but suffice to say, there are different, more challenging kinds of pollutants than we had in the days where it was just straight, unregulated municipal and industrial discharge. Now we have regulated facilities, but we have more complex pollutants, which offer new challenges to us. As you may also know, we are governed in the state of Oregon. There's a combination of ways that we run our agencies. Some agency directors report directly to the governor. Others report to boards and commissions. I'm one who reports to a commission, and that commission is the Environmental Quality Commission. And that there is a tab 1, that gives our current membership for you. That commission is appointed by the governor, and they are appointed for a four-year term that can then be renewed for another four-year term. And there's currently one vacancy on our commission. It's normally a 5-member commission. Although we are not required to have those be geographically representative, we have always tried to have the members be from around the state because they feel very strongly about holding meetings out around the state as well as having the department being active in the communities that we serve. That, as was noted earlier about our willingness to travel around, in the early 90s when I was the Hazardous and Solid Waste Administrator for DEQ, the agency was highly centralized in Portland. We're unique in that our headquarters is in Portland, and I think that is linked to the history of how the agency started and also because that's where most of the regulated sources were at the time and pretty much continue to be. Anyway, in the early 90s, then-Director Fred Hansen made a decision to decentralize the agency, move it out of Portland. And today, we have most of our staff is located in the field offices throughout the state, and that includes Bend, Coos Bay, Eugene, Grants Pass, Hermiston, Klamath Falls, Medford, the North Coast, Pendleton, Roseburg, Salem, and the Dalles. And we just opened a field office in the area. So we are very, very committed philosophically and physically to having our folks out living and working in the communities that they serve. And those of us who are in the Portland office are very willing to travel anytime we need to. I'm sure you also know that we do a combination of programs. We do some of the federal laws that are enacted by Congress and empower EPA, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, Resource Conservation Recovery Act that governs waste programs. The way Congress sets those federal programs up, EPA can delegate them to the states if the states want them and if EPA thinks the states are capable and have demonstrated capability. We historically have been a strongly delegated state. Our legislators, our governor, and our stakeholders have all been very supportive of the state taking delegation of federal programs, and so we are delegated now for almost all of the federal programs that we can be delegated for. One notable exception is the federal Superfund or cleanup program, which is not allowed by Congress to be delegated. We do have our state-only cleanup program that the legislature enacted in 91, I think, but for the national priority list sites like the Superfund Harbor Cleanup in Portland, that's a shared responsibility with EPA. We also carry out environmental laws that the legislature here in Oregon passes. A couple of examples of those are the Groundwater Protection Act, the Toxic Use Reduction Act, and in your packet, Lori will be talking a little bit about Senate Bill 43 at Tab 9, which relates to some changes that are proposed in that Toxic Use Reduction Act in this session. All the rules, we are not an agency that can adopt any rules by fiat, if you will. I can't just raise my hand and say it shall be so. All of our rules must be adopted by the Environmental Quality Commission with extensive public process involved in the adoption of those rules. Also, I always want to be sure and say in my testimony that any fines that we collect under our civil enforcement authority go back to the general fund. There are a couple of small exceptions to that where some money comes directly back to specific activities at the department, but those are the exception, not the rule, and by far 98% or so of our penalties go to the general fund. I want to share with you a bit what I've tried to do, my vision for the agency, as the second point I want to cover since I became the director. That was, I must say, to a great degree informed by the 6 years that I spent in Eastern Oregon in charge of all of DEQ's operations in Eastern Oregon when we decentralized the agency in the early 90s, and really helped me as a native Oregonian, although raised in Portland, develop an appreciation for some of the pressures on rural Oregon in dealing with the programs that we implement. And I'm sure I don't have to tell you the complexity and the difficulty of the environmental problems that we deal with, both at the state and federal arena. one of the things that we don't talk about too much, but DEQ plays a very key role in, is dealing with urgent environmental problems, either spills, toxic releases, drinking water contamination, surface water contamination of an emergency nature. We had, for example, at the end of last year, there was a spill in Cow Creek. There was a diesel train derailment and a spill that was threatening the spawning ground for the coastal cohort. Also threatening some of the cultural resources for the Cow Creek tribe. We were very involved in getting that spill cleaned up. We've also been working on long-term contamination concern around Springfield, some potential drinking water contamination from a dry cleaning facility that has since been closed. So we get involved very much in those kinds of more critical crisis public health protection kinds of issues, as well as just the ongoing care of the environment and monitoring of air and water and that sort of thing. One of the other things that I feel strongly about is that we cannot do this job by ourselves, and that we really must work with Oregonians to get the job done. The collaborative model is one that the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds has used, and also that the economic revitalization teams use. We are very supportive of those models and of those approaches, and very active in both of those. Our agency was an original Community Solutions Team agency and is now an Economic Revitalization Team agency. And at the same time, of course, sometimes we have to have the hand of the regulator. So we try and do our enforcement and our regulatory work in as people-friendly a way as the nature of that business allows it to be done. My first priority and vision for, and we have at tab two, I have a handout of our strategic priorities. The first one that you will see in there is that we strive for excellence in everything that we do. And some might argue that that is not a strategic priority, but I do believe that if we set the bar very high for our written work and our communications and everything that we do, the permits we issue, that the vision of a well-run agency will follow. I also believe that it is important for us to be fair and equitable in how we implement and enforce our regulations, and that our focus will be on solving problems, not just running programs. And I will be honest and say we do not always do this perfectly. And I'm sure each of you has had experience with constituents who can tell you that that is so. But we strive to do so, and I want to hear about it from each of you if there are problems that are not getting addressed to your satisfaction, and we will do our best to do that. My job, of course, and the mission of the agency is to protect public health and the environment, and that will always be my top priority to do that as the director. I'm not going to go through the whole booklet of strategic priorities, but I will just highlight what is in there for you. These four strategic priorities have remained constant since I became the director. We just did an update at the end of last year. The first is delivering excellence in performance and product, as I said. And this is not only for our science and technical work, but also in our policy work and how we deal with the people that we serve here in Oregon. And a good example of that is the septic tank program. This is a program that I think many of you are familiar with. We deliver that program directly in about half the counties in Oregon, and in the other half, the counties deliver it on our behalf, and that is allowable anytime a county would like to take over responsibility. They are allowed to do so. But it is unique in that we are working with very small businesses and with individual Oregonians when we deliver that program. And that means, in my view, we need a different kind of approach than we would use with a large corporation or a large municipality that may have an environmental staff that's pretty sophisticated on the regulations and what they need to do. So over the past couple of years, we have been implementing and have implemented a customer service program in our specifically targeted to to our septic tank program and all of our field staff. And our customer service surveys that we did in 2002 and then in 2004 show that that effort has paid off and that the customer satisfaction climbed from 51% in 2002 to 77% in 2004 after we completed the training. Obviously, we still have more to do to get the percentage up even higher, but that is a priority for us. Our second priority, you'll see, is protecting Oregon's water, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit more specifically when I talk about the programs in a minute. The third is protecting people's health from toxic chemicals. I alluded a minute ago to some of our emergency response type of activities. Also want to point out that we have a laboratory that we work jointly with the state public health lab. And we are, in addition to our ongoing monitoring efforts that we share with them for drinking water, ambient air, our laboratories are the point of first response in any kind of a terrorism or unknown substance event. The FBI or the first responders will bring those substances to us for analysis. We are also, as an aside, we're the regulatory entity responsible for the chemical weapons destruction facility up at near Hermiston at the Umatilla Army Depot. We regulate that facility as well. There is a handout at tab 3 on our emergency response responsibilities. And then our fourth strategic priority is to, in fact, involve more Oregonians in solving environmental problems. And I alluded to this earlier, that we cannot do this by ourselves. We have to engage others in helping. And I have indicated at tab 4 an example of a campaign for healthy lawns that we worked on with some of our local partners, and that's a page from our website. About 80% of the pollution that we have in our state is really from the activities that all of us do. We are not a heavily industrialized state, so we don't, for example, have some of the air quality problems that they do in the Midwest or the Northeast from having a lot of coal-fired power plants. Our activities are really more from individual Oregonians and practice. You'll hear the term non-point source or area source, those kinds of activities. I want to talk briefly now, my third area, about a brief overview of some of the specific program activities. As I mentioned, of course, we protect clean air, clean water, cleaning up toxic spills, and ensuring the proper disposal of hazardous and solid waste. We also try and promote recycling and waste reduction, and the legislature in the past, of course, has passed the Opportunity to Recycle Act that we have here in Oregon. And as you all know, we do issue permits and we do take enforcement action, and those permits do regulate the amount of pollution that is allowed to go in the air or in the water, also regulate generators of hazardous waste and treatment and storage facilities for hazardous waste. We have made progress. I would mention, I know performance measures are of great interest. The customer service performance in the septic program I mentioned earlier is an example of a performance measure and one that we have achieved successfully that our customer service surveys showed. On the clean air side, in 1980, only 30% of Oregonians lived in areas with clean air. Today, I'm very pleased to say that we are 100% in attainment with all ambient air quality standards throughout the state, and that is another performance measure that we keep track of. As population...
Madam Director,
yes.
Could you tell us a little why that's changed? Your graph here is just outstanding.
Oh, yes, I need to tab 5, right. This graph, it represents you'll see an abbreviation there, NAAQS, I apologize for that. That stands for National Ambient Air Quality Standards. That represents several different pollutants, and there are a variety of reasons for why we are in attainment. I'll give you some examples. In southern Oregon, the primary pollutant of concern, most notably Klamath Falls area, Medford area, Grants Pass, was particulate matter, and that comes from wood stoves, from dust, that sort of thing. Those communities really stepped up to the plate and implemented aggressive measures a number of years ago to come into attainment. There was a wood stove buyout program. There's a whole host of things that have been done in those communities. And most recently, they have both in the Medford area, I think, is the most recent one to have been designated as being in attainment. Klamath Falls was, I think, a year or two ago. LeGrand also had a particulate matter problem and took measures and came into attainment as well. Another type of pollution would be from automobile exhaust, ozone, of course, and the metropolitan Portland area, we have a vehicle inspection program, and also in the Medford area where ozone pollution was a problem. So that's another mechanism that has been used successfully to bring down the pollution from automobiles that would contribute to not meeting standards. On the industry side, there has been a new, in the last few years, federal program. You'll hear it referred to as Title V. That refers to Title V of the Clean Air Act, and that has brought in some new regulatory requirements on industry. That program is delegated to the state, and we do administer it here. It is supported by fees paid for by industry, and those have brought in additional controls. So it is a variety of efforts. It's been the willingness, really, of our communities and our industries to step up to the plate and do what's necessary to bring our state into attainment, and I think it's something that we can be really proud of. I do think we have to continually be alert, and we do monitor. This is one of the purposes of our air monitoring, to tell us where we may face problems in the future so that we can get out ahead of it and take action so that we don't go out of attainment. We also, in addition to the regulatory work we do, we have a fair number of loan and grant programs and technical assistance activity. Probably the largest is referred to as the State Revolving Loan Fund, which we have had since 1991, about $497 million to over 100 communities throughout Oregon, which is used to help finance the upgrade of sewage treatment plants. There is also a similar fund that is administered on the health side for drinking water systems in communities. That's not a fund that we administer. As an example, the city of Grants Pass has received $7.1 million for design, planning, and upgrade of their sewage facilities. The city of Umatilla has received more than $4 million for design, planning, and upgrade of their facilities. And there are many, many communities that have been helped by this. At tab 8, you'll see Senate Bill 42 that Lori will talk about, which are some housekeeping changes to how that fund is administered to just make it a bit easier for the communities to pay off the loans. We also try and provide technical assistance to help improve pollution control. We recently provided some assistance to a truck repair business in Pendleton, and they were able to change their practices so they could shift out of being a higher quantity generator of hazardous waste into a lower quantity, which basically took them out of the regulatory requirements that they would have been subject to. And that's simply by using less toxic chemicals or changing their practices in some way. I would just point out here, I know we're not going to talk a lot about budget, but one of the things that is important for us is we are very highly fee-funded, which I will go over in a minute, but the general fund we do have, this area of technical assistance is an arena that is very, very important for that general fund, because we really do not have in any other funding sources that pays for that kind of activity. The fees that are paid by the people we regulate go to issuing their permits, doing compliance inspections, etc. The federal government as well does not choose to use their grant money for technical assistance. So hazardous waste is probably one of the most notable areas in which we are highly dependent on general fund to support this kind of technical assistance work.
Madam Director, one question. You mentioned earlier that the penalties do go into the general fund,
yes.
And now you're saying it really goes to just those problems?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we do not have any control where the general fund that comes from our penalties goes after it goes into the general fund. It is not earmarked for DEQ. It goes into the general fund, and you all decide how general fund will be allocated. Whatever general fund we get in our budget, we do request by program. We request some for water, some for air, some for hazardous waste. And within our hazardous waste program, the part of our hazardous waste program that does technical assistance work, the general fund we have in our budget helps to pay for that. But there's no direct relationship between the money generated by penalties. One could propose there would be, but right now there isn't.
You are talking about the general fund, the general fund, not a general fund within your department.
That's correct.
It goes into the fund, and then you have to request it back out.
That's
for these
correct.
Programs.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. We do have some notable success stories about where we have a relationship with fee payers, and out of that fee revenue, we have been able to generate programs.
Question.
Yes.
Yes, thank you, Chairman. I see how is DEQ funded, and you show 2% from Measure 66 lottery funds. Could you explain those two funds?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen, the only lottery dollars that we have in our budget are in the water program, and they are specifically directed at the setting of total maximum daily loads through the Oregon Plan for Salmon Watersheds. That's all the lottery money we have.
Well, it's 2%. It's not a large portion of your, okay. The TMDL is...
Yes, sir.
And that's your monitoring function with that, then? Is that what those...
Yes, sir. Part of it is for monitoring and also for just working on setting those load allocations.
Oh, okay. Okay, thank you.
So, Mr. Chair...
Representative Lou.
So, lottery money, 2% is what? About the... $13 million. How much that might be?
Lori Allen has a specific answer to that question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, this is a breakdown of our total budget, our operational fund. Our operational fund is approximately $164 million a biennium, and so 2% of that is around $3.5 million. So $3.5 million of lottery comes into us to do clean water plans, or what are called total maximum daily loads for clean water.
So 3% of your total budget.
Of our total operational budget.
Operational
right.
budget comes from the lottery.
Right.
Okay. So it is not 2% of the lottery.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, that's correct. It's 2% of our operational budget.
Okay. Thank you.
I will speed along here so we can get to budget, since you're obviously interested in that. The program I was alluding to, where we have partnered with others to use fee revenue to provide grants and to support communities, is in our solid waste program, where part of the tipping fee is devoted toward giving grants to local communities for solid waste planning, for doing recycling, and to otherwise meet their needs to manage solid waste. We also have household hazardous waste collection events that we do jointly with the communities. We provide money for those, and we help staff those. And the fee payers are supportive of that, because that helps them in running their municipal solid waste activities to have some of those materials taken out of the waste stream and otherwise dealt with. So that program has been very successful. Just to note, and this again would be a performance measure, in terms of the success, we have a statewide recovery rate in recycling of 47.3% in 2003. We also have, I have some on page 6 of my testimony, an example, another performance measure with regard to our leaking underground storage tank program, where we show we have cleaned up 90% of the approximately 24,000 tanks that since this program started that we've needed to deal with.
Again, that percentage was maybe...
Almost 90% of the leaking underground tanks have been cleaned up or are being cleaned up. There are also, beyond underground storage tanks, there are over 1,000 sites, general sites, cleanup sites that are contaminated with toxic substances that are have been cleaned up or in the process of being cleaned up. Remember, I mentioned earlier there is a state cleanup program in addition to the federal one, and those 1,000 sites are the sites that are in our state cleanup program.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lynn.
Thank you. Under this underground storage cleanup program, do we have some kind of the grandfather right if it were maybe 1945 or before that they don't have to dig it up? But what's the rules?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lim, the short answer is yes, there are exemptions, and as a matter of fact, the compliance date for underground storage tank, the federal program, was 1998, and so by 1998, in theory, all of the tanks had been identified, and everybody who needed to come in compliance or was exempt had done so. The primary work that we're doing in the underground storage tank program now is cleaning up sites where there had been contamination that were identified, and also the program requirements that had to be in place by 1998 required service stations and people like that who were going to stay in business to install new tanks or upgrade their tanks and install new equipment. We do compliance inspections to be sure that has been done so we don't have the program have to start all over again, basically. That whole federal program had a series of exemptions, and we can certainly give you the detail on what that was, but most of the folks who knew about the program and knew they had to come in compliance are aware of that, and they have done so by now.
Okay. This is a very complicated issue.
It is. Yeah. There. You will have an opportunity this session to discuss it. We have a Senate bill that Lori will be talking about in a few minutes. This program was scheduled to sunset at the end of this year. Last session, there was a request that we look at whether or not we wanted to. This is one program where we do not yet have federal delegation, as I was speaking to you about before. The legislature wanted us to look at that. We've been working with our stakeholders. And we are proceeding to get federal delegation, and we're going to be coming to you to request that the sunset be lifted and we continue with the program. Okay. We can talk some more about that in a moment.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things I don't think you've touched on is fines in terms of your funded. What happens with the fines that you... Do those come back in? Do they go into general fund? What happens to them?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen, yes, the fines, are these are civil fines, and they do in fact go into the state general fund. There are a couple of programs where they come back to DEQ to fund program activities, unless Lori knows I can get you the specifics, but it's tanks is actually one of them.
Pardon me?
Underground storage tanks is actually one of them.
Okay.
But it is the exception, not the rule.
Okay, and... what kind of revenue do you generate out of the fines for the state general fund?
It varies, but it's generally in the $1 million to $3 million.
All out of my district?
No, sir. I certainly hope not.
Well, I've seen some, and I'm not quarreling with them, but I've seen some. Pretty significant fines, you know, come through. And one of the things, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to particularly commend the agency for, and that is the keeping at least me in my district informed, so that when these things happen, I have some. And if I do get constituent calls, complaints, or concerns about it, I'm not floundering looking for. What's going on, and I really do appreciate that as far as the agency is concerned. I was just curious about how much, you know, kind of the ballpark figure on fines, and recognizing they'll vary from year to year, and, you know, those sort of things.
Right.
Correct.
Ms. Halleck, I want to get back to the underground storage tanks just for a moment. Because back when the Brownsfield? Isn't that what that federal program was at that time? Or
actually, Representative Garrard, Mr. Chairman, the Brownfield program is really more part of the Superfund cleanup. It is specifically targeted at cleaning up, for example, old mill sites that could be rehabilitated as opposed to a green field, which would be a pristine property that had never been developed. And Brownfield might have some contamination, clean it up, and then we could use it again.
Follow, Mr. Chair. Question is, I remember an area up in Klamath County, northern Klamath County, quite some time ago when I was still back as a commissioner, that we found leaky old gas station that had been there 20 years ago, but when the folks, when it rained real hard, the water came up to the top, and the groundwater came up, and it had a beautiful slick to it, you know, from the gasoline. And the people were long gone. Mm-hmm. There wasn't any way. So that area got on a list for a state-supported cleanup. And that's what I was curious about. Are there still a lot of those sites remaining to be cleaned, or are they all taken care of now? And did that come out of your budget?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Garrard, those are excellent questions. They are not all cleaned up. We hope they are all identified by this time. There is a state fund, and it is affectionately referred to as the LUST Trust Fund, the Leaking Underground Storage Tank Fund, which you may have heard of. And that fund, the general rule for cleanup at the federal and state level, whether it's underground tanks or any kind of cleanup that is debatable and has been debated, is joint and severable liability, which means that whether or not it is abandoned, one of the first things that we do is we try and go back as far as we can go back and try and find a responsible party to pay for the cost so that the taxpayers don't have to pay for it in general. Where that cannot be done, there is a fund, and then the cleanup side, there's the, you've probably heard the term, the orphan fund, and tanks, there's the LUST Trust Fund, so there are funds available to do those cleanups. And LUST Trust is funded from Arlington, I think. I have to get the exact funding. There's probably some federal money in it. We also have funding from the hazardous waste disposed of at the Arlington disposal site, but I can get you the specific breakdown.
That's not necessary. I was just curious as to where we were in that, whether there's still a lot of those sites remaining or whether most of them had been.
We can get the exact number for you as well on underground tanks. One other thing I did want to mention since you brought it up is the overall funding of cleanup is, when you look ahead to future environmental problems, is of concern. The funding source at the federal level for the federal Superfund has stopped. It was a tax on industry, so the Superfund is declining nationally. For the state cleanup program, we have generally sold bonds to fund some of the state orphan cleanups. We are not, there is no recommendation in the governor's budget this time around for selling more bonds. We have some concern about how we are going to be able to fund cleanups as a state in the future. In particular, Representative Garrard, you may have heard about Alkali Lake out in your part of the world. That is going to be a real challenge for us as a state. So that's just sort of to flag that. I don't have any particular issue to bring up with you today about it, but it is a long-term concern.
Is the Alkali Lake a natural body, or has it been contaminated in some way by human contamination?
Representative Anderson, I just violated Lori's principle, which is never bring up anything you don't absolutely have to, but I would be happy to tell you about Alkali Lake. It is a dry lake bed, which many years in the 60s sometime, I think, the state at that time made a decision, and we all learn more as time goes by, to allow barrels of toxic chemicals to be buried there. And there is, of course, a legacy issue that was not anticipated that has to be dealt with. Okay, moving right along here in terms of... yes, sir.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you.
Yeah, oops.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Not quickly enough.
Stephanie. I wanted to ask you about changes that are happening at the federal level and how those affect your agency, because I see that one of your principles is keeping delegation of federal regulations so that the state is carrying them out. And I know that this area is in some flux. So are there things going on at the federal level that will affect how you're able to do your job here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, the greatest concern, well, let me just digress for a nanosecond here. I am currently the Vice President of the Environmental Council of the States, which is the National Association of State Environmental Directors. And if nothing changes, I will become the President and then the past President, and I've been the Secretary Treasurer. The reason that's important for Oregon is that puts me in a position of not only for all states, but particularly for our state, to be able to have a dialogue at a very high level with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and also on the Hill if needed. That dialogue right now, there's been a transition at U.S. EPA, as I'm sure you all know. Governor Mike Leavitt has gone to Health and Human Services. We do not know yet who the replacement's going to be. At our council, we are framing our positions that we want to take forward, because we will have a meeting soon with EPA to talk about what is important to the states. At the top of the list is concern about funding, but it is similar to coming to this body to go to the Hill. You don't go to the Hill and say, gee, we need more money. You've got to have specific targeted needs, and you got to talk about why they're important. So some of the things that we have been discussing, overall, the federal share, it is estimated that there is about $1 billion gap between what the federal government provides to states and what the states then need to do to deliver the programs. And in terms of the federal funding that is provided nationwide, there's an estimated to be about $1 billion gap. That has existed for some time. And there are cuts proposed in EPA's budget. None of us in the states anticipate that we'll go back to Washington, D.C. and be able to get a whole bunch more money sent to the states. But that is not to say we won't try. We are trying to target specific programs to ask for that money in. I've mentioned the fact that the Superfund is declining. One of the other key agendas for all of us, and that is particularly important to me, is there has got to either be more funding in the drinking water and the wastewater state revolving loan funds, or there has got to be some regulatory relief for very small communities. They cannot meet the water quality standards, particularly for drinking water. They don't have the money to fix their infrastructure, and it doesn't do any good when we go out and issue a fine or whatever it is we do to solve that problem. So that's another big issue. At this point, I mean, I don't want to take the committee's time, but I'd be happy to come talk to you more about the national issues. But I just want to let you know there is that forum. We are developing a national agenda. It's hard because, for example, the Midwest and Northeast states I alluded to earlier have huge air quality issues that they want to have on the national agenda, where some of our air quality issues might be a little different. And in the West, of course, it's all about water. So we do our best to frame a national agenda. But when I have more information, when I've had that meeting with EPA, I would be happy to come back and talk with you all about how that went and what it looks like might be happening. Thank you.
I could just ask a question about that. If smaller communities, rural areas, cannot meet the needs, the policy, I guess, is just to overlook it, as opposed to changing the policy a little bit.
Well, and Representative Anderson, Mr. Chairman, our goal would be, quite frankly, at the national level, to get the policy changed. I mean, that's where under the Clean Water Act, there would have to be that kind of initiation at the congressional level. What we do in this state, and most notably the South Coast, is a good example where they have had some real problems, and we've worked with Representative Krieger and others on some of those coastal communities, and we've done it in other parts of the state as well. But we try and enter into what we call a mutual agreement and order, which sets out a time schedule that is long enough to allow communities, in most cases, to raise their fees through some kind of an initiative that has to be passed in their community. The state revolving loan fund that I mentioned earlier can provide some money to help with the upgrades, but it is a real problem, and there is not an easy solution, and there really has to be congressional change to get a long-term solution to it. All of that said, we are working at improving the water quality, which is another one of our performance measures. We currently have, in the streams that we monitor, and we don't monitor everywhere, but in the streams that we do monitor, we see water quality improving in about 64% of those surface waters, and about 1% is actually declining. We estimate we have about 13,000 river miles that fail to meet clean water standards in some way. And obviously population growth will continue to be a challenge to keep having clean water for us, both groundwater and surface water. Clean water is the priority for this agency this session. And Lori's going to talk more about our legislative concepts, but we've had an increase. The number of permitted facilities that we had in 1994 in the state was about 2,700. We're up to 4,000 now in 2004. There obviously have been new federal requirements that have come down that we've had to implement. We also, as you may have heard, had a large permit backlog in our water program. This is what our the result of an effort that we put together over the last couple of years is Senate Bill 45 in your packet at tab 11. We had an advisory committee to overhaul our wastewater program. They've come together with a proposal that includes some legislation, includes some general fund, and includes an agreement to have a fee increase to help fund the activities. Over the past year, we redirected our staff off of compliance work and some other work to help reduce the backlog. We were able to do that, and we reduced it from a 45% permit backlog to a 27% permit backlog. So it can be done with the adequate resources. And I would ask for your support in particular for this piece of legislation and the policy package that will be in our budget that will go with that. That I'm going to catch a breath here because that's sort of the programmatic overview, and then I was going to shift into budget and legislation. So I just want to be sure I've answered any question that you might have at this point about the programs.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Berger.
I just wanted to note that in my district there are a number of wastewater treatment systems that are under review or replacement or installation, notably Cresswell, Coburg, Brownsville, and then along the edges of it, Lebanon and Sweet Home, I think, also have issues. So in addition to other members of the committee, this is an area of great interest and concern to me. Recently, we were talking in Coburg about a potential for user fees for a household exceeding $100 a month, which, from a financial point of view, of course, is impossible. So I'm going to have a huge interest in whatever way we can help you to get financing or deal with financial issues around these wastewater treatment systems. And, of course, in Coburg's case, it's not just the treatment plant itself, but also the collection system.
Representative Barnhart, I appreciate that, and I'm sure that the League of Cities and others have this issue at the top of their list nationally for
they do,
lobbying. And you also have the added benefit of recently been designated a groundwater management area.
Yes. Thank you.
I'd like to ask that sometime on the agenda in the next few months we talk about step systems and small diameter sewage treatment capacities. which would cut the cost, especially in the more rural areas. I think the department has done quite a bit of work in the past, and but maybe we could have an update on that to tell us how we could help, and maybe in that area or other areas that you see on the horizon that would help some of the rural communities get the treatment they need and yet cut the cost.
We'd be happy to do that. I'll move to the budget briefly. We talked about it just a minute ago, and on page 8 of my testimony is a brief summary. As I mentioned earlier, we are now up to about 66% funded by fees from the folks that we regulate. We have about 21% from the feds, about 11% from the general fund, and as Lori was discussing earlier, 2% from lottery dollars that are dedicated just in the water program. Natural resource agencies as a whole are about 1% of the state's general fund.
What page is you on?
This is my testimony, which I hope is at the very top of your packet.
It's actually page 5.
Oh, sorry. I'm working off a cheat copy, so thank you very much. Wait till everybody's with me. The natural resource agencies as a whole are just 1% of the state general fund. So we're generally, people are more interested in talking about our programs, really, than they are about how much we might potentially contribute to the general fund. Over the past 3 years, as the state has faced budget problems, our general funds were reduced by about $15 million. This is sort of a bittersweet thing to say. About half of that was because of an efficiency that we were able to get approval from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. The State Revolving Loan Fund that I mentioned to you before, the debt used to have to be serviced by general fund. We were able to get them to approve servicing the debt by the proceeds, that there were sufficient proceeds to service the debt, and that was actually able to save about half of that. That $15 million that came from DEQ came from that change. The rest of it actually came out of our programs, where general fund cuts were made in our programs. For the 05-07 governor's recommended budget, the biggest reduction in general fund is in our air quality program. It's about $1.1 million. In the governor's budget. I mentioned the initiative we took on the debt service with the State Revolving Loan Fund. We have been focused on trying to do more streamlining and more efficiency. During the interim, there were two advisory committees on regulatory streamlining that the legislature set up last session, and I was on both of those, and there will be reports, I'm sure, and recommendations and findings coming to the legislative body this session. But in addition to that, at DEQ, we went through a couple years ago in our air program, a streamlining of our permitting process, much like we've just done in our review of the wastewater program. We also had, it doesn't sound like a big deal, but it was a very big deal for us. We converted about 18,000 folks that we had on a paper mailing list to an email subscription service, and we're in general trying to make much more use of electronic media as a way to do business. People can submit their monitoring reports for water quality, for example, so that's another initiative where we're trying to do more as well. Tab 6 in the packet has our legislative priorities just on one fact sheet, and then we have individual fact sheets for the various bills I've talked about. I would just say as I'm closing here that one of the things that we have tried to be more sensitive to is the close relationship between environmental protection and the economic well-being of the state. And in particular, when we redid the strategic priorities last year, our last strategic priority is involving Oregonians and solving environmental problems. And we have a key action in here that used to say support communities in solving environmental problems. That key action now says support communities in solving environmental and economic problems. And I think it's just a fact of doing business that we have to be sensitive to that. And that's one of the reasons that I think that the regulatory streamlining work is so important. So for this session, we have three principles in what we're bringing forward. The first is to try and enhance services that make it easier for businesses to locate and thrive in Oregon so that we will seek efficiencies and process streamlining while maintaining environmental protection. Secondly, to maintain the environmental accomplishments to protect public health and clean water, air, and land that we have attained over the years. We've made a significant investment as a state over the last 30 years in protecting our air and water, and it is what and our land. It's what Oregonians are known for and what Oregon is known for, and to a great extent attracts people to live here and invest in our economy. And we believe it's important to maintain these successes. And thirdly, as we've discussed today, to keep delegation of the federal regulations, as difficult as it may get to be with shrinking federal dollars, we still believe it's important to be in control of our own destiny, if you will. Our budget and our legislation proposals are based on these principles. As I said earlier, clean water is a top priority. One thing I didn't mention because it's not a bill is we do have a general fund request for resources to support the continued work on the Willamette River. And once we set the total maximum daily loads to actually implement those and assist communities in doing so. So I will stop there and turn it over to Lori to briefly go through our legislation with you, unless you have further questions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ferris.
One of the difficulties of being a member of this body was the fact that we gave DEQ instructions to get out there and inform the community more of what they're doing. Ms. Halleck may correct my numbers, but as I recall, she had a fund of around $600,000 that was earmarked for education, and the dreaded Ways and Means found that money and took it from you right before the end of session.
Representative Gride, that was the waste tire fee, that's correct.
Yeah. Well, whatever it was earmarked for, it was for educational purposes, but as I say, you wound up volunteering it to reduce the budget.
In quotes.
So nothing is safe. I guess that's the best way to put it.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Lori Onan. I work on budget and legislation for the Department of Environmental Quality, and I thought I would take a few minutes to just briefly explain our legislative concepts that we have put in for this session, introduced by the governor. And they're actually in order, starting at tab 11 of your packet, and I'll just start with the top one. That one is Senate Bill 42, and Stephanie has talked a little bit about the Clean Water State Revolving Fund a couple of different times. It is a fund that is maintained by both loan repayments from communities that have gotten loans from us in the past and are now paying those loans back. The interest rates, by the way, are very low for that. And right now, with the interest rates being as low as they are, they can be as low as 2 or 3%. So that it does go up and down with the market. Also, it's capitalized by federal grants. So every year we do get federal dollars that come, not enough federal dollars, but they do come into the state to help with that work. The statute needs to be changed because the way the statute is written now, people have to start paying their loan back before they've completed construction on a project. And this bill would do is say, you don't have to start paying your loan back until you complete construction on your project. So we think it lengthens out the loan term by maybe 2 to 5 years. Gives people a little bit more time to pay back. Maybe their loan payments can be a little bit lower. So that is pretty much that one. We hope that one will be fairly straightforward. Any questions on that one?
Actually, these all start on tab 8.
Yeah.
Tab 11 for the end.
Right.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Purposes.
Thank you.
What effect does this have on the integrity of the fund, if any?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, it should have no effect on the integrity of the fund in the sense that when we are doing, we do bonding to get the money to put out these loans, and of course, that's part of the bonding. You have to demonstrate that you've got the stream of income coming back in to pay it, and that's completely not an issue. This has all been looked at, and we have great bonding staff, and we work with Treasury. So.
Treasurer Edwards will take care of that.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair?
I'm sure you will.
Yes. How much is their total revolving fund?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, it is upwards of $70 million right now.
Okay. So, $70 million is all out, or?
No.
How much do we have reserve?
I don't have that with me, but I could get that for you.
Okay.
Follow up on that, if I may.
Yes.
I assume that whatever you do have in reserve is encumbered by the by your bond indentures or by commitments that you either have made or in the process of making for new loans.
Again, I'd have to get back to you with more specifics on that.
Right. Thank you.
If I could just interject, Mr. Chairman, on the fact sheet, it refers to the projects. We do have a priority list of projects, which, if you will, encumbered or earmarked at present. So I would suspect the answer to your question is yes, but we'll get the specifics.
Thank you.
You mentioned earlier that the state revolving loan fund was $497. What was the $70 million fund? Did I mistake?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Mr. Chairman, since 1991, the $497 was how much had been given out since 1991.
Okay. And it is a total of $70 million now.
Mr. Chair, yeah, there's a fund that kind of keeps replenishing itself and as money comes in, and it's around that. I could get the exact number.
All right. Proceed.
The next bill, should be under tab number 9, is Senate Bill 43, and this is regarding Oregon's toxic use reduction law that Stephanie mentioned. In 1989, the legislature passed this law, which requires certain businesses to develop a plan to reduce the use of toxic substances. This was one of the first in the nation to look at this comprehensive approach, and the goal was, again, to look at where it made sense to change processes or use different kinds of products to make things less toxic in the workplace and then less hazardous waste as a result of that. We've definitely been working on that with businesses since that happened. The law has not really changed much since 1989, so we've had a couple times where we've talked with stakeholders, including the environmental community, about where this should be going. And after last session, the group got together and spent this past interim looking at how to bring this law updated, and they came up with a list of changes which are listed in this fact sheet. One of them is really paperwork reduction, so it's streamlining in the sense that the current law requires annual reporting, and when somebody's done a plan, one might say, well, we've done a plan, and do we have to keep telling you what we've done yearly? What we're going to look toward is two implementation summaries and somehow linking that to a website so that it will be more publicly available than just having an annual report that is maybe not as widely available. So that's one change. We think that we can use this information to help other businesses by saying, here's what one company's done. It's similar to yours. Here's some information that can help you. We also are looking at changing it to exempt certain businesses where they're using a product which you can't find a substitute for, and an example would be wood products because it's naturally in the wood product, and you can't, the fact that you've got a wood product, when you process it, it creates toxins. That's not something you can substitute for. So it would take that out. It would actually align what we require with the federal toxics list so that there's not two different lists people have to go to and look for to say, do I have to comply with this law? And then there is currently a, if people don't comply with submitting their plan, they have to hold. We were supposed to hold a public hearing about that. It's something we've never done, and so the idea is to remove that requirement. We have found that, as Stephanie mentioned earlier, we have our technical assistance program, where our staff work with small businesses in large part on this kind of work to help them find ways to reduce toxics, and that we've found that that's a better way to get this planning to happen. And so that's, those are the proposed changes.
These bills will mostly be introduced from the Senate side.
Mr. Chair, yes, they've actually been assigned to the Senate Environment Committee, and I think they're supposed to schedule hearings fairly soon. So the next bill is Senate Bill 44, and again, this is something that Stephanie mentioned in her testimony, the underground storage tank program. As she mentioned, this program was set to sunset at the end of this year, and what we've done is worked with the stakeholders who pay the fee, and we've decided that together that we think that the state should continue to carry out this program. So this bill would continue the fee. It would also continue what we started out as a pilot program for expedited enforcement or streamlined enforcement, if you will. As you might know, a lot of the operators that have underground storage tanks are small businesses, and when we go out into the field, we're trying what's called a ticket program. Instead of having a long, drawn-out enforcement process with a lot of paperwork, again, they're given an option. If they have a small violation that they fix right away, they can pay a field ticket and then be done with it as long as they come into compliance. So that would also continue. One of the things that we have done that I think the regulated community likes and wants us to do this program is that we have worked with the industry to do training, because again, these are small businesses doing underground storage tanks, and they've got a lot of other things to worry about aside from this. And so what we've done is put together training to say, all right, here's your new upgraded system, here's the leak detection system, here's how to make sure it's operating safely, here's how to make sure that you know what equipment you need and how it should be operated. So they actually do compliance, which means that in over the long term we don't have leaks again. So compliance is the goal. And last but not least, Senate Bill 45 is our water quality permit program improvement. And Stephanie talked about the fact that we have had this permit backlog. Clean water is really important. And we have a budget proposal that's going in. This is the companion legislation. What happened is in the last 2 years, we had what we called a Blue Ribbon Committee, and that was industrial, local government, environmental, and folks got together and looked at our program and said, what do we need to do for the long-term stability of the program, and then how do we pay for it? The things that came out of it were the fee increase and general fund request that's in our budget request. And then this bill does a few things. It promotes a watershed approach to improve program efficiency. It makes sure that we set performance standards and do annual reporting to both you as well as the public and our regulated community on how are we doing with compliance, how are we keeping up with inspections, how are we doing with our permit backlog. And then it does to attempt to keep stability for the program funding as well as predictability for the fee payers, allow for up to a 3% annual permit increase to help address inflation. So those things are all in the legislation. And that the only other piece of legislation we have is a fee ratification bill that will be going to Ways and Means. It's House Bill 5027. What that's about is when our Environmental Quality Commission adopts fees in the interim between sessions, and those are not in legislation, they have to be ratified by the legislature, and so the process is through Ways and Means, and we have a few of those.
Representative Correns.
Lori, on that last page, it says, what is the 2005-07 budget proposal? It says DEQ is requesting about $420,000 in general funds and $544,000 in increased fees to phase in 4 additional staff. If I'm reading that, you're spending $1 million on 4 additional staff?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, I thank you for pointing out that this fact sheet could be improved. After it says phase in and 4 additional staff, it says and keep existing service. So there are some staff that we can't afford to keep right now because fees don't keep up with inflation.
At $250,000 a biennium,
it's not 4, it's more than that. It's also keeping some folks that we already have, so plus adding. Did that answer your question? Or
Yeah, isn't the right answer, but yeah, it's an answer.
Maybe some specifics. You get this.
Sure.
So, Mr. Chair, would you like further information?
No, that's all right.
Okay. Representative,
I'm quite sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When was the last time the fee increased?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, the last time there was a water quality fee increase was in 2001.
Okay. After that, not you didn't cut off the fee increase after that. This is the first time you requested an increase since 2001.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, that's correct.
Okay.
Staff has pointed out a good question on Senate Bill 43. As we align what the state requires with the federal toxics list, is that going to increase our cost or decrease our cost? Is it going to be a softening of the list?
Mr. Chair, costs to DEQ or costs to the...
Cost to the state.
There is no fiscal with this bill. There won't be any change in what we need to move. It's really more of an external... Right now, when companies try to figure out if they have to do a plan, they have to look at two different lists. And this says, here's one list that you look at versus two. And so it's more help for them.
And this is one I intended to ask earlier, and we got on to the next subject. Are there significant, I mean, I understand what you're talking about from an administrative point of view. Sure makes a lot of sense to look at one piece of paper than two. But is there a significant difference between what's on the two lists? Will this degrade or enhance streamlining or toxic use reduction and hazardous waste reduction in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, we think it will enhance it. Because of, again, this was worked out with a group of stakeholders, so everybody that was involved with it, with this program has agreed with this legislation, and we think that this will actually result in more toxic use planning in the state than is happening right now. So there will be actually additional companies that would be doing it that aren't doing it now because of going to the federal list.
Because of
going to the federal
and
list.
Is that because the more companies will be required to do it, or because it's easier to do and therefore they'll come into compliance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, it's because the federal list is more comprehensive.
Ah, mm-hmm. That answered the question I was really trying to get to. Thank you.
But still no increase in need for funding.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Any other questions? One question I have left, and that is, well, actually a couple. That the federal Superfund is really the only fund that we don't really control. We handle our own destiny in all of the other areas to a great extent. All of the fees go to the state, essentially, to do those programs. That covers all of the federal needs, or is this an area where they are, in fact, giving back to the taxpayers of Oregon by letting us keep the fees and whatever comes in, they take nothing? Do you understand what I'm saying? That seems to me that this is an area where maybe we're on the negative side, but it's an area where they're not getting anything for all of this, and yet they do provide some service to us. Is there no cost?
Well, Mr. Chairman, and I'm not sure that I fully understand, but we could probably work our way through this. Mm-hmm. The federal, when Congress set up the federal programs, they acknowledged in the way they wrote the laws that the federal government itself was not going to be able to do all the work. So they wrote those laws understanding that work would be delegated, some of it could be delegated to states, and then the federal government would have to give money to those states to do the work. But there's also an expectation, if you accept delegation, you have to demonstrate not only some legislative, that you've passed laws to have the authority and that you've done all that kind of stuff, but you also have to demonstrate that you can do your share financially as a state. So what the feds get out of us is someone to do the work, and currently they're getting us to do the work than many would say for less than their fair share, because that's why we're 66% fee funded, is because our fee payers have stepped up to the plate and said,
we want you, Oregon DEQ, to run these programs here rather than have EPA do it. So we're willing to pay periodically tax ourselves, if you will, with a fee increase to ensure that you can keep delegation. So it's a very delicate balance, and many states are really starting to ask themselves whether or not they can continue to do this. And some states may choose to give back programs. EPA may take programs back. You may have seen in the Oregonian recently some comments about our wastewater program and the Fed's recent review of it and whether or not they would consider taking it back if we couldn't do it adequately, which is one reason a legislative proposal is so important to us.
Okay.
So I don't know if that answered your question or not.
I think so. That it's an unfunded mandate, essentially.
It can be, Mr. Chairman, or very close to it, and that's certainly a big part of the conversation that the states have with EPA all the time.
Okay.
Actually, it's on this topic, and kind of a follow-up. If the EPA were to take back a program, what would the financial effect, if any, be on people who now pay fees to Oregon?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, the effect could be that those fees would go away. I mean, hazardous waste is an example where you might continue to pay some fee for some kind of service and technical assistance or whatever that only the state is providing. But that's always sort of the tension in the dialogue that you have with the regulated community and what they have to weigh for themselves and could certainly come in and talk to you about is, okay, is it worth it for us to pay the state to provide this? And, you know, where do they get to a point and their bottom line where maybe it isn't worth it, and they would just as soon have to deal with the federal government.
Mm-hmm. But, Mr. Chair, they like you so much more than they like the EPA that they're willing to pay you to keep doing the job.
Mr. Chairman,
what it sounds like you're saying.
Representative Barnhart, I would certainly encourage you to invite some other folks in to answer that question, but we believe very strongly for as long as I've been in this business as in Oregon, that running delegated programs is the best way to protect the environment and deliver the service and is the most efficient in terms of getting the work done.
I think you answered my question. Thank you.
Just along the same line, Mr. Chairman.
Who is to say that if we were somehow or another to relinquish this and our fees therefore went away, that the federal government wouldn't assess fees as well?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen, I don't have a precise answer to their authority to do that, but I'll find out whether or not they have
authority to assess. Fine.
They do have the authority to fine, and they do that.
Generously.
In some cases, Representative Jensen, that is so.
If you do get all of the requests that you're making of the general fund, will that in any way offset the $1.1 million that the governor has cut?
That's a very interesting question, Mr. Chairman. The general fund that we are requesting, most of the new general fund we are requesting is in the water program. The cuts have been in the air program. So holistically, yes, there's an offset, but programmatically, the air program would still be cut, even though some of the services in water might be enhanced if we receive that general fund.
You can shift them between the funds?
We cannot. We are not allowed by the legislature to shift among the programs.
Okay. Representative Jensen.
Thank you. Destiny, we had an issue circulated a little bit before this session began regarding air quality and ethanol gas in the metropolitan area. I think most people were somewhere or another, or are some way or another, familiar with that. Can you tell me where that's at right now, and what's happened, what is on the horizon?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen, I can. The issue for those of you who are not familiar is the question was asked earlier how we maintain air quality standards. One of the ways that we do that is we have a vehicle called a maintenance plan that is developed for communities, each community around the state who has air quality problems. There is, and for each pollutant. In the metropolitan Portland area, we were developing a maintenance plan for carbon monoxide, which is an emission from automobiles. That maintenance plan is something that has to be approved by our commission. We had taken forward a proposal to drop a requirement in that maintenance plan that required the city of Portland to use what is referred to as oxygenated fuel in the winter months. And what oxygenated fuel is gasoline that has an additive in it to make it burn more cleanly. In this case, the additive of concern was ethanol. We have been well in attainment with the carbon monoxide standards in Portland for some years, and so we were proposing to drop that requirement. It has been dropped in other communities around the state. The commission took action in December on that proposal, and what they enacted, they did not drop it immediately. It is that requirement is dropped in 2 years. So for now, the city of Portland must continue to use oxygenated fuel in the 4 winter months for another 2 years, and then that requirement is dropped. Now, in addition to that, the governor's Climate Change Advisory Committee has made a series of recommendations to the governor with regard to alternative fuels. Also, one of the recommendations is for Oregon to adopt the California tailpipe emission standards. There are a number of items in that report that remains to be seen what the governor will do with them, and or whether there will be legislative proposals brought to all of you during session, not by us, but by others, to implement any of those. But to answer your specific question, that requirement is in place for 2 more years.
Follow, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Stephanie, the curiosity in the state of Oregon, the ethanol that is used in and has been used in the city of Portland, is that a domestic product, or is that one that's imported from outside of the area?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen, it has been imported. Ethanol is made primarily from corn, primarily from the Midwest. There have been at least 2 and maybe more now businesses that have been interested in developing the capacity in Oregon. One is in Columbia County and one is in the Treasure Valley. And those facilities, one of them in particular, they were very active in providing testimony on this issue. But to date, it's been imported from outside the state.
If I may, Mr. Chair, it is my understanding a good portion of that ethanol was not just imported, but was imported from foreign countries.
Boy, Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen, I'd have to check on that. I don't know.
Thank you.
Like at some point in the future to have you maybe come back and share with us some of the progress on the Willamette and the Portland cleanup that's going on or is going on.
Right. Be happy to do that.
Good. I guess my final questions, and I'm sure open to, we've got a little time if anybody wants to ask them, but you're facing a budget crisis like most of the other departments. Are there ways that you can become more effective, possibly through contracting with local environmental engineers and people like that, involving them in your staff, but them not being really part of your staff? Have you thought about different cost-cutting procedures so that you can maintain the level of efficiency?
Mr. Chairman, that's an excellent question. We do some of that now. For example, I mentioned we have a laboratory. Some of the services the lab provides are contracted out, and we've actually worked with a laboratory advisory committee to continually seek other services that we might contract out. A lot of the cleanup work in general is done by contractors. Most all of it is done by contractors, and we do some oversight of those contractors. There is something that you may hear discussed called receipts authority. That's the shorthand term, but there was legislation passed a few sessions ago to give us the authority to collect money to expedite work to a certain extent, but there's a caveat in there that is challenging to know how to deal with, and that is when people pay a permit fee, they expect to get a fee for that service. And the legislation specifically did not want to create an unlevel playing field whereby people who had more money could get their permit up to the top of the line. So what we try and seek is, okay, if there's a special study or a special plan or there's some kind of a requirement associated with a permit that we could collect some extra money for, wouldn't necessarily change somebody's place in the queue, but we could expedite that piece of it, we try and do some of that, and that is generally done by using contractors. An example that quickly comes to mind down actually in the Klamath, we had, I think, CH2M Hill did some work for us on the TMDL down there. So we do some. I think there's definitely room for us to look at how to do that and more. And what also goes with that is more self-certification, where you have requirements that if you have, rather than have us necessarily have to review everything, if you have a certification by a CEO or some licensed engineer or something like that, that would be acceptable. But it's something we certainly need to continue to work on doing. Also, IT. We contract a lot of IT stuff. I think everybody does.
One final question in two parts. How many overall employees do you have in DEQ? And could you break that down generally by air, water,
I don't. Do you have it with you?
Or you want to bring that to us?
It's 800 and some, and 500 and some of those are in the field or in the lab or vehicle inspection, and 200 and some are in our headquarters. That goes to the decentralization that I talked to you about. But I'd have to,
sure.
I don't know, I can do it off the top of my head, how many are in each program.
Maybe if you could give us a structure and just general, that would be wonderful. All right. I think we've exhausted the questions.
Not
the people. Yes, Representative Jensen.
Could I ride this horse a little further?
Sure. That's what we're here for.
The diesel fuel, the off-road diesel program, or where's that at?
Representative Jensen, you're going to have to help me.
Diesel, maybe?
Well, no.
The
diesel
regulation, or
yeah, diesel engines are particularly the farm diesel and construction are reported to be major pollutants, polluters of the air. Is that, am I not correct on that?
Representative Jensen, this would be in our air toxics program, and I am ignorant, and we'll have to get back to you on whether or not we have any regulations in the work with regard to those. I don't think we do. We are involved in the West Coast Clean Diesel Initiative, which EPA is very supportive of, has put money into it. We work on that collaboratively with British Columbia and the other states in the region. We've been focusing on truck stop electrification has been a big project. So I'm not personally up to speed on the farm diesel and that sort of thing, but I will check with my staff and find out if there's anything particular going on.
Well, it's my understanding that the technology is pretty simple and available to really clean up diesel emissions through biodiesel. And I'm curious. There are several things that come to mind as possibilities with this. One of which is, perhaps a real economic development as far as the state of Oregon is concerned. And secondly, since we're a state that has wanted to and made some real claims about clean air and our efforts to clean up the air. If there's any activity within the department to encourage, to promote, to help in the economic development of biodiesel and production in this state.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen, we are very actively involved in all of the conversations about biodiesel. As a matter of fact, one of the members of our commission, Ken Williamson, who is a professor at Oregon State University, this is a particular interest of his, and there are folks at Oregon State who have been doing a lot of work on biodiesel. Kevin Downing is our staff person, and so we are, and also the governor's advisory committee on global warming has recommendations in there with regard to biodiesel as well. So yes, we've been very much in the conversations, and will continue to be. In terms of specific proposals, that I'd have to get back to you on. I don't know what's in the works.
I just, colleague, and I'm sorry to kind of labor this point a little bit, but I go back to the ethanol issue. Oregon really does not have the corn production, and corn is the principal crop where ethanol would come from. Iowa can produce more ethanol accidentally than we could produce with all of the efforts, basically that we could muster on. However, biodiesel is a product that can come from a variety of sources of vegetable sources, and we have more than abundant ability, from what I understand, to be able to be extremely competitive in the development of biodiesel. And I think it's one of those things that, economic development wise, clean air wise, would be smart for us to look at and work very hard on. Just comments, the chair.
Our producer, Senator Jensen, you're singing my tune.
Yeah.
We were just talking this morning about the possibility, probably within 2 or 3 weeks, bringing biodiesel and some of the other fuel catalysts to testify. I think this is a wonderful area that we need to clean the air and increasing efficiency, conserving fuel, increasing...
Reduce our imports of oil.
Hey. We can do it.
Not only that, my diesel engine will last longer.
You mean reducing our need to drill?
Thank you. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the clarification. That is exactly what I meant.
That's the energy department.
Right.
I'm sorry. And by the way, that was not a planted question that I or comments.
Appreciate it, because I think it's been an area of major interest for all of us. I think we're going to have a very denouement of what's going on.
Yeah, that'd be useful.
Well, I certainly appreciate you both coming. We're going to be hearing from you, I'm sure, quite a bit during the session, and I just invite you to come and listen in on some of the other discussions that really relate to your department.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing on the last point, I'm sure you know this, but the Department of Energy has really played the lead role on all of these alternative fuel issues, and I would encourage you to invite them as well.
Good. Excellent. Thank you, Mark Kendall. All right, thank you very much. I will put us into adjournment.
But you're the key.